From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. During his lifetime, George Washington owned hundreds of slaves, but in his final will, and to the surprise of his friends and family, he stipulated that all his slaves be freed. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Henry Winsick about the profound moral struggle that led to Washington's decision. Winsick is the author of the new book, An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Want One, the third album by Rufus Wainwright, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History by Devin McKinney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether foreigners detained at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo, Cuba, have the right to go to the U.S. courts to challenge their detention. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Defying a Bush administration request to stay out of the case, the High Court said it would hear arguments in the Guantanamo case early next year. The case, brought by two British detainees, two Australians, and 12 Kuwaitis, is the first major test of the Bush administration's anti-terrorism policies to get a Supreme Court review. The detainees contend that they're being held illegally since they've been held for more than 18 months without charge, without any trial, and without access to family or lawyers. The Bush administration contends it has the power under the Constitution to hold enemy aliens overseas without intervention from the U.S. courts. Some 660 prisoners captured in Afghanistan and Pakistan during the Afghan War are being held at Guantanamo. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. is offering more support for anti-terrorism efforts in Saudi Arabia after the weekend bombing that killed at least 17 people in Riyadh. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher.
We have said it bears the, it looks like Al-Qaeda, it smells like Al-Qaeda, it has all the earmarks of Al-Qaeda. But until the investigators reach that as a conclusion, I just put a little bit of let them come up with a final answer, not me.
Boucher said the Saudi government has been doing more to prevent attacks since a similar bombing in Riyadh last May. Last week, the State Department warned U.S. citizens that terrorists might be planning an attack in Saudi Arabia and temporarily closed its missions there. The World Trade Organization has upheld an earlier decision that U.S. steel tariffs violate international trade rules. The decision clears the way for what could be billions of dollars in retaliatory duties on U.S. manufactured goods. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
The WTO decision on the tariffs to protect the domestic steel industry was expected. However, this latest ruling from the group's appellate arm puts even more pressure on the Bush administration to lift the tariffs put in place last March. Now that the body has upheld the earlier WTO decision, U.S. producers could face over $2 billion in retaliatory duties on U.S. products ranging from citrus fruit to Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And the administration has also run into increasing opposition to the tariffs from some domestic manufacturers who claim they've boosted their prices for steel and cost jobs. However, lifting the tariffs may also not be easy for the administration, since it could lead to a possible backlash in steel states and potentially cost votes in the upcoming 2004 election. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 53 points to close at 97.56. The Nasdaq was down 29 to close at 19.41. This is NPR News. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham said today that President Bush will sign an energy bill even if it doesn't allow oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Abraham told reporters at the National Press Club that the administration is not happy that the bill will probably not contain the oil drilling provision, but he said it's more important to have energy legislation passed this year. A judge in South Dakota said today that prosecutors may not use Congressman Bill Janklow's past driving record as evidence in his second-degree manslaughter trial. Janklow faces the felony charge for an August traffic crash that killed a motorcyclist. Kurt Nikich reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
The prosecutor wanted to introduce as evidence records of three traffic accidents involving Janklow and 12 speeding tickets he received since 1990, but the judge said those are only marginally relevant to the August crash and could prejudice a jury against the state's only congressman. However, the judge will allow as evidence a reported near collision involving Janklow at the same country intersection last December. Police say they clocked him driving 92 miles an hour after a woman reported nearly being hit. The judge ruled the alleged close call is relevant to the pending case and would not unfairly bias a jury against the defendant. Representative Janklow's trial is scheduled to start December 1st. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The Federal Communications Commission said it will allow consumers to switch their home phone numbers to their cell phones. The FCC says people will be able to make the switch as long as their cell phone coverage overlaps the location of their home phone. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on assignment. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's one of the more wrenching ironies of American history. The Founding Fathers not only owned slaves, but in some instances had children by them, failed to free them, and permitted slavery to be accommodated in the constitutional system. George Washington himself kept 300 slaves at Mount Vernon and had slaves serve in his presidential homes in New York and Philadelphia. But by the end of his life, this had become a torment for him, and in his will, he made provisions for their eventual freedom. How he came to this decision is the subject of historian Henry Winsick's new book, An Imperfect God: George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. Winsick found evidence in Washington's private papers, in court records and archives, that the first president had begun to see the evils of slavery even before he took office, but that he regrettably let social, financial, and personal pressures overcome his moral qualms. Henry Winsick has written extensively on race in early American history and on plantation life in Virginia. Winsick says that Washington's decision in 1799 to emancipate his slaves sets him apart from Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and his other contemporaries, that it was truly revolutionary.
We look back on that time and think that the Founding Fathers simply did not see the evil of slavery and that they did not think that the African Americans were fully human beings. And that's simply not true. I mean, I document in my book how many of the founders said things that reveal that they were deeply aware of the evil of slavery. But Washington was really the only one who acted upon it. He was the only founding father to free all of his slaves. Jefferson died possessing about 200 slaves, and he only let five of them go in his will. And two of them were either his children or his nephews. Another one was related to him distantly, and the other two were loyal servants. But Washington really stands out. He's almost unique.
Well, one of the strongest bits of evidence, of course, is George Washington's will, in which he wrote that his 123 slaves at the time of his death, after his wife's death, should receive their freedom. So how much detail, though, does he go into in the will? And what can you read into the wording about how he came to this decision and the circumstances of it?
You can read a tremendous amount into that will. It's really an extraordinary document. I think one of the most important documents that Washington has left us. But a couple of things struck me when I read that will. First of all, it's the second longest clause in his will, and it's the first major clause in the will, right after the customary one-line bequest to of all of his property to Martha for as long as she might live. He went into this emancipation clause, which runs for almost three pages. And the other thing I noticed after reading the entire will a couple of times is that the language of the emancipation clause is incredibly vehement. It's almost like a field order. It has the harsh tone of command to it, as if he were talking to people he knew would try to resist his will. And he uses phrases like, this clause respecting slaves must be religiously obeyed without evasion, neglect, or delay. It's extremely strong language.
Now, Washington did come from a line of politically influential men, but his father died when he was very young, and his own financial prospects were very bleak, and really it was his marriage that was the making of him. And through his marriage, he gained a good deal of property and slaves. So I'm wondering, what this means in the context of his life, that he would come this far by the end of it, and how his family circumstances and the place he occupied in this social order informed his thinking on slavery.
Well, his all of his family members held what we might call traditional or conventional ideas about slavery. And by that, I mean that they saw the slaves as a source of wealth. Martha, for example, really clung to that idea. I have an interesting quote in the book. You see, Martha, as many people know, was married before she was married to George Washington. Her first husband was Daniel Park Custis, who was an enormously wealthy planter. He died very suddenly when Martha was, I believe, 27 years old, leaving her with two small children and an enormous fortune of about £40,000 in land, slaves, and cash. And when Washington married her, he was marrying one of the largest fortunes in Virginia. And that fortune is what allowed him to build Mount Vernon into the plantation that it became. Without Martha's money, he couldn't have done that. And she never gave up the idea that slaves were one of the foundations of the Custis family's wealth and status. It's interesting that when she wanted to marry Daniel Park Custis, his father almost would not allow it, because he dismissed her as being much inferior in point of fortune, in his words. And Martha did not want that to happen to her children and grandchildren. So she was determined to hang on to her slave property.
Washington owned at one time hundreds of slaves. What kind of master was he?
He was a surprisingly harsh man. This was one of the things that was sort of difficult for me to come to terms with, because we like to think of the great founders such as Jefferson and Washington as being benevolent toward their slaves. But the records really show, without any arguing about it, that his slaves were miserably clothed, they were miserably housed, they worked very hard. Physical punishment was routine on Washington's plantations. It was not unduly harsh or brutal, but it was there. And the slaves were on his plantations were so badly clothed that they were stealing the wheat sacks made of the cheapest, roughest burlap to repair their own clothes. And this outraged Washington and his manager that the slaves were stealing. But the slaves otherwise would go around in rags. It was a very harsh place.
I'd like you to read a letter that you quote in the book that Washington wrote to a captain of a ship bound for the West Indies. It's concerning a troublesome slave that he wanted to unload.
Yes, this was about a slave named Tom, who in 1766 had run away from Mount Vernon, and Washington had to pay £2 to have him recaptured. But no sooner did he have him recaptured than he sent him off with this letter, which was written to the captain of a schooner headed for the West Indies. "Sir, with this letter comes a Negro, Tom, which I beg the favor of you to sell in any of the islands you may go to for whatever he will fetch. And bring me in return for him one hogshead of the best molasses, one hogshead of the best rum, one barrel of limes, if good and cheap, one pot of tamarinds, two small pots of mixed sweetmeats, and the residue, much or little, in good old spirits. That this fellow is both a rogue and a runaway, though he was by no means remarkable for the former and never practiced the latter till of late, I shall not pretend to deny, but that he is exceedingly healthy, strong, and good at the hoe, the whole neighborhood can testify, which gives me reason to hope he may, with your good management, sell well, if kept clean and trimmed up a little when offered to sale. I shall very cheerfully allow you the customary commissions on this affair, and must beg the favor of you, lest he should attempt his escape, to keep him handcuffed till you get to sea or in the bay, after which I doubt not but you may make him very useful to you. I wish you a pleasant and prosperous passage and a safe and speedy return, being, sir, etc., George Washington."
You know, it's so breezy, that letter.
isn't it? That's what struck me reading it. Considering he's essentially sending this man off to a likely death at hard labor on the sugar plantations.
That's right. The West Indies plantations were notorious for their terrible conditions, and where slaves were routinely worked to death. And Washington knew that because he had spent some time there as a teenager. But it's really upsetting to see or to hear the breezy tone with which he sends this man off to a likely death. It's a picture of Washington that we don't like to see. It's Washington as the young master, almost exulting in his power over this slave.
Now, DNA testing has confirmed that Thomas Jefferson had children with at least one of his slaves at Monticello, Sally Hemings. Have there been similar cases made for George Washington? Have any descendants of slaves at Mount Vernon come forward?
Yes, there was a lot of controversy about that. Right after the Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings DNA announcement in 1998, some descendants of a slave named West Ford came forth and said that the oral history in their family had always maintained that George Washington was the father of West Ford. And there were a number of problems with this, one of which is that that specific oral history had never been written down. So with the Jefferson and Hemings stories, that oral history had been written down in the 19th century. But putting that aside, there were also other problems with the story, because West Ford's mother was a slave named Venus who lived on George Washington's brother's plantation, not at Mount Vernon. And the brother's plantation called Bushfield was about 90 miles away. So at first it was thought that it was impossible for Washington to have met Venus and to have been West Ford's father. However, I came across some documents that had been overlooked until now, which showed that it was technically possible for Washington to be West Ford's father, but I strongly doubt that he was.
Well, what do you make of this chapter, at least in the George Washington history? How does he?
I think
that you haven't, despite sleuthing, you have not been able to uncover any offspring of his.
I don't. There have been rumors swirling around Washington of one sort or another for many, many decades. I mean, I ran across one funny quote that he was known as the Stallion of the Potomac, and there have been long rumors that he had a long-term affair with Elizabeth Powell, who was the wife of the mayor of Philadelphia during the presidency. But there's really no substance to this. The fact of the matter is Washington was very striking. He was very handsome, very tall, very powerful-looking man, and he was magnetic to women. But there's the other side of that is that he was a very disciplined man, and he was obsessed with his reputation, rightly so, because he felt that his reputation was important to the reputation and integrity of the government. So I find it very, very unlikely that he would risk his personal and public reputation for an affair or even a brief encounter of any kind. That's only my opinion. I have no firm evidence. I mean, Washington never set down in so many words, I have never done anything with that woman.
I'm talking with Henry Winsick. His new book is An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. We're going to take a break now, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with historian Henry Winsick. He's the author of a new book about George Washington and how Washington came over the course of his life to renounce the institution of slavery. It's called An Imperfect God. What's the earliest evidence that you uncovered that signals a real shift in Washington's opinion about the morality of slavery?
The first evidence I saw came about really in 1775 when a correspondence with one of his managers reveals that for the first time that he was refusing to break apart slave families. He was trying to buy a skilled slave from a plantation in Maryland, and the man did not want to leave his family. And there was a really striking sentence in the letter from the manager saying that the man would rather die than leave his family. And Washington had agreed with the slave and with the slave's owner that he wouldn't take the slave all by himself unless he wanted to go, but if the whole family became available for sale, he would buy them. And that's a really remarkable thing because it shows that Washington had crossed a psychological divide. Because just a few years before that, he had been he'd been buying and selling slaves without any compunction. And at one point, he even raffled off slave children to collect a debt that was owed to Martha's family. You see, the interesting thing is that there are really two Washingtons, one from before the Revolutionary War and one after. And there's almost no comparison. The man was not the same for his whole life.
Well, what do you think got him to that point in 1775?
I think that he was just moved by the horror of seeing black families broken up. I do a lot of research with African-American genealogists today, and I hear a lot of oral histories. And one of the things that keeps popping up in these oral histories is, in terms of the brutality of slavery, the brutality seemed to come more from stories of families being broken up than from physical brutality. I think that our modern thinking about the harshness of slavery has been formed by visions of Uncle Tom's Cabin, of harsh whippings. But when you hear the oral histories, the pain that mostly echoes down in the generations has to do with the brutal separations of families by forced sale. And I think that Washington began to see this. And the other thing that changed him, I think, was the heroism and loyalty of so many black men during the Revolutionary War who fought for the American cause.
I'd like to talk about the war. You write in the book that George Washington won the Revolutionary War with an army that was more integrated than any military force until the Vietnam War. That really struck me. Also that reportedly a quarter of the Continental Army was black.
At one point, right.
Three-fourths of Washington's bravest regiment. So how instrumental was Washington in enlisting so many African-Americans into the army?
He was, because this couldn't have been. He was very instrumental. This could not have been done without his support. To me, the most striking thing was that I found out that at the end of the war, when the army was dwindling, when manpower was one of the gravest problems facing the American cause, the men with Washington represented the hardcore of devotion to the American cause and to Washington himself, and an astonishing number of them were black men. There's a diary written by a German officer on the French staff who visited Washington's camp in 1781, and when he looked out over the soldiers, he said a quarter of them were Negroes, merry, confident, and sturdy. And then he said, three-quarters of the Rhode Island regiment consists of Negroes, and that regiment is the most neatly dressed, the best under arms, and the most precise in its maneuvers. Now, this remark in the diary of the German officer would be just a little footnote of history, except that a few weeks later, Washington and Lafayette handpicked the Rhode Island Regiment to lead the decisive attack on the British at Yorktown. So that the unit that won for us our liberty and rights was three-quarters black, and we don't know that. I think that's something that we all should know because, I mean, that bit of history, a lot of history actually, has been stolen from African Americans, and that's one thing that everyone should know.
Do you see it then as a pragmatic decision on Washington's part at first, that he needed the manpower and he was impressed with the regiment and that pushed him over the line of disregarding race?
That was partly it. The issue of allowing blacks, either slave or free, to enlist in the Continental Army came up the very moment Washington took command in July of 1775 in Cambridge. When he arrived there, he looked around and he saw something that must have shocked him as a Southern planter. He saw all these black men walking around carrying guns. And I'm sure he'd never seen that before, except for the handful of favored slaves who were allowed to go hunting for the master. But one of, in one of their first councils of war, the American officers, Northern and Southern, decided to ban blacks. But later in the fall, a group of former black soldiers came to Washington's headquarters and said, in Washington's words, that they were very much dissatisfied at being discarded. And Washington changed his mind. He decided to take these men back in. And that was really the first time that he had capitulated to an appeal from black men. And he also needed them. And in the horrible winter at Valley Forge, when the American cause was very short of troops, Washington gave his consent and his enthusiastic consent to recruiting a regiment of blacks in Rhode Island. And that formed the nucleus of the first Rhode Island regiment that fought at Yorktown.
So did Washington go on record to recognize the importance of African-American soldiers during the Revolution?
No, he never did. And it's very curious because after the war, the Marquis de Lafayette often spoke of the valor of black men. Lafayette was the officer who was probably closest to George Washington. And after the Revolution, Lafayette begged Washington to begin emancipating his slaves. He said something interesting. He said, "My dear general, an example such as yours may render it a general practice," meaning emancipation. And when he toured America, he always made a point of visiting with black veterans and embracing them in public and stating that the American cause had been won with African-American blood. But the white American officers were very reluctant to acknowledge publicly the contribution of the slaves.
Henry Winsick's new book is An Imperfect God, George Washington, His Slaves, and the Creation of America. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Broken Music, a memoir by Sting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with Henry Winsick about George Washington and the moral struggle that led him to renounce slavery at the end of his life. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Rufus Wainwright, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with historian Henry Winsick about George Washington's evolution from slave owner to emancipator. Winsick's new book, An Imperfect God, explores Washington's treatment of his slaves and his gradual acknowledgement of the inhumanity of slavery. The story casts doubts on the myths of the first father of our nation and his moral stature. Reading your account, Washington sounds so conflicted, and I think that's never more apparent than in the period after the war, after Washington was elected to the presidency, and he moved his family north, first to residences in New York and then Philadelphia, and he took slaves with him to the northern states, which had different laws pertaining to individual freedom and the legality of slavery. How did Washington respond to the new atmosphere that was less supportive of the institution? And what does this chapter in his life say about him as a man?
Well, Washington was shocked to find out that Pennsylvania had passed a law saying that any slaves who resided in Pennsylvania for more than 6 months could become free. At first, he thought that he would be exempt from it because he didn't regard himself as a permanent resident of Pennsylvania, but only there as part of his business, namely being president of the United States. But an interesting thing comes out of this, and it's not very very flattering to Washington. He instructed his secretary to trick the slaves into leaving Philadelphia before they could obtain a six-month residency. He said, find some excuse to bring them down to Virginia before 6 months is up, and then bring them back, and the clock will start again. And, you know, he said that I want this done under a pretext that will deceive both them and the public. And so it's not a very flattering thing for the man who supposedly could not tell a lie.
A number of slaves did run away during this period, and it sounds as if Washington came to something of a personal crisis in his dealings with runaway slaves, particularly with one slave, Ona Judge. Tell us about
Judge,
that.
Ona Judge, she touched off a major crisis. And also the episode of Ona Judge, I think, takes us really into the psychology of the Washington family, because you see here a real split between the thinking of George and Martha Washington. Ona Judge was a house servant, a young servant. She was just in her late teens, and she was very close to Martha Washington. She was a seamstress, and she was Martha's personal servant. She helped get Martha arrange her hair and get dressed, and she took care of Martha's clothing. She went to public events with Martha. She was extremely good looking. She was almost white, which was one reason she was chosen for that post, as Martha's. As she would be sort of the public face of slavery, someone who was very, presented herself very well, who looked intelligent. And even though she was the most pampered of all the slaves, she hated slavery, and she ran away. She successfully, with the help of the underground in Philadelphia, she managed to get on a ship which brought her to New Hampshire. Now, Martha was outraged at the ingratitude of this slave who would run off from her inner circle. Washington, it seems, was inclined to let Ona Judge go, especially since she'd gotten all the way to New Hampshire. But Martha was enraged and went to Washington and said that she was going to take out an advertisement to get Ona Judge brought back. Washington was appalled at this because it would be a tremendous blow to his reputation to have the sitting president advertising for a runaway slave. And the other thing they were afraid of is that Ona might have been made pregnant, according to a rumor going around, by Martha's own nephew. And this is all in the book. John Adams wrote it down in his diary. But Martha insisted, and so George Washington had poor Ona pursued and almost kidnapped. But Ona was very smart. She eluded everybody who went after her. And she made it plain to a federal official up in New Hampshire that she had run away because she wished to be completely free, and she had great respect for the Washingtons as persons, but she would not go back to slavery.
When did Martha learn of his change to his will?
I think that she didn't know about the Emancipation Clause until it was read to her when her husband was in the ground. There is very strong evidence that Washington kept his final emancipation plan a secret. He wrote to some of his relatives before he died, explaining to them what land they would get, what property they would get. But he never said that they would not get slaves, which is really extraordinary because that was one of the most important things that they would have to plan for. And it's obvious that he was keeping that part of his plan secret. So, and I think from the language of the clause, it seems that Washington expected that Martha would be surprised by this.
Was slavery something that George and Martha Washington talked about? Is there any record of that?
I think that the fact that from Washington's will, we can see that the emancipation would have come as a shock to Martha, that shows that by the end of their lives together, they weren't even speaking about slavery. From looking at other family wills, you can see that that husbands and wives very carefully sat down and planned and negotiated what the distribution of assets would be, including slaves, when a husband died or a wife died. In this case, they didn't. George and Martha did not do that. It's obvious that Martha didn't have any part in planning George Washington's estate. I think it's because they were so far apart on the issue of slavery that they couldn't even speak about it.
So as you understand it, it was family pressures along with the financial and the societal pressures that kept his hand in slavery until pretty much the end of his life.
Until the last summer of his life, when it seems that when there's very strong evidence that he had a premonition of death, and that's why he put on paper his final emancipation plan. He did not want his wife's family to get their hands on his slaves if he died suddenly and unable to write a will that would free them. And as I interpret it, I say this at the end of the book, that I read his will as being a tacit appeal from beyond the grave to Martha and her family to join him in emancipating all of the Mount Vernon slaves, but they refused to do it. It's interesting, Martha owned only one slave in her own name, legally, a man named Elish, and she refused to free even him. She refused even to make a symbolic gesture of solidarity with her husband. It's really striking, and she was determined to preserve slavery because it was the source of her family's wealth and status.
Well, what in the end do you come away with from having traced George Washington's path? I mean, we knew he owned slaves, but that he decided so late in the day to renounce slavery. What are we to think, better or worse of him?
Well, his decision did not come all that late. I mean, his final decision was written down in the last year of his life, but I found indications that 10 years before that, in 1789, he had already begun to talk in private of an emancipation plan. And he came up with that idea just before he became president. And I think that he may have been pondering making a public gesture beginning to free some Mount Vernon slaves to set a precedent that the chief executive of the United States does not hold slaves. Then later on, he wrote that one of the things that was holding him back from freeing his slaves was his concern over the political repercussions. Because during his presidency, the country was almost torn apart by debate over a treaty with Great Britain, Jay's Treaty. And Washington thought that the country was being driven to the brink of a precipice, in his words. And it was exactly at that time that he began to think again of a plan for freeing his slaves. But he was worried about the public impact. On the other hand, I also speculate that he may have wanted to touch off a strong public reaction through an emancipation. It's hard to know what was in his mind because he wrote down so little, and he was such a secretive person. You really have to dig very deeply to find his motivations.
Well, Henry Winsick, thanks very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Henry Winsick's new book is An Imperfect God. Coming up, a review of a new CD from Rufus Wainwright. This is Fresh Air. Rufus Wainwright has just released his third album, called Want One. In many of these new songs, he intimates and at times directly addresses the unhappiness and substance abuse he's talked about in recent interviews. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
Men reading fashion magazines. Oh, what a world it seems we live in, straight men. Oh, what a world we live in. Why am I?
Rufus Wainwright commences Want One with that composition, Oh, What a World, elaborately arranged, invoking Ravel's bolero. Wainwright moans, quote, what a world my parents gave me, always traveling but not in love. It's an almost absurdly over-the-top piece of self-pity, so extravagant you find yourself shaking your head, either in admiration for its gutsiness or wonderment at its mawkishness. The song is aptly chosen to lead off this intentionally baroque, bitter album.
Thought that maybe we'd fall in love over the phone. Thought that maybe I'd really love being alone. Everybody but heaven knows how I was.
In that song, Vicious World, Wainwright sings, Oh Lord, what have I done to myself? And in interviews promoting Want One, Wainwright is talking about what he's done to himself since the release of his last album, Poses, 3 years ago. Consuming a lot of drugs and alcohol, venturing into what he called in the New York Times a, quote, gay hell, and doing a stint in rehab. You could say that the music that results from this is in his blood. As the son of singer-songwriter Kate McGarrigle, Rufus knows how to make misery artfully pretty. As the son of singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright, he knows how to be fearlessly autobiographical.
I don't want to make it rain. I just want to make it simple. I don't want to see the light. Just want to see the flashlight. I don't want to know the answer.
My chief problem with Rufus Wainwright is that, unlike those parents he alternately blames and loves, a bit too intensely for a man of 30, I might say, he's become mannered in an almost unbearable extent. He's taken that gorgeous tenor voice of his and, with each succeeding record, exaggerated his melismatic slurs and florid croon. He knows how great he can sound, and that knowledge seeps into every arrangement on Want One. It's less a showcase than a showing off of technique, of musical eclecticism. He started out full of a spiteful energy and go-for-broke emotionalism. On this album, however, his voice officially becomes a trademark. I can almost hear the little copyright circle above every distended phrase. As for the layered production style, much of it comes straight out of 70s West Coast pop music, whether he's invoking Van Dyke Parks' art records of that era or a Mamas and Papas arrangement like this.
You got my lost brother's soul. My dear mother's eyes, brown horse's mane. My uncle's name. You watch me
Throughout Want One, Rufus Wainwright sounds unhappy, restless, and exploited in his endless pursuit of happiness and contentment. This is a classic theme in much gay culture, in novels and movies, as well as pop music. The problem is that Rufus isn't adding much to the tradition. For a guy who claims to have gone through so much in his three decades, he still seems stuck on feeling abandoned by daddy. Loudon Wainwright divorced Kate McGarrigle when Rufus was three, and the subsequent abandonment is something that has haunted both men. The father has written many songs about his own loudishness, sometimes masking his shame and pain with humor, sometimes not. The son is still all bruised pain, as he proves on the album's closing song, Dinner at Eight, which gives full vent to a fight Rufus has said he had with his father over a meal they had after a Rolling Stone photo shoot.
No matter how strong, I'm gonna take you down with one little stone. I'm gonna break you down and see what you're worth, what you're really worth to me. Dinner.
The frustrating thing about that song, and so many others on Want One, is that Rufus sidles up to pent-up emotions, ready to release them in a torrent, only to drown them in string sections and coyly oblique metaphors. He's not yet enough of a wordsmith to earn his Cole Porter world weariness, let alone his father's just plain weariness. And if he doesn't watch it, Rufus won't be the tunesmith who will provide his fans the passion and release that they, and he, crave so much.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, Beatlemania and beyond. This is Fresh Air. In his new book, Magic Circles, Devin McKinney tries to crack the mystery of what made the Beatles something entirely more than just a rock and roll band that happened to become extraordinarily popular. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says he comes closer than a lot of other Beatles scholars.
"You look like a Beatle," my husband told me a few nights ago. I was curled up in a chair reading Devin McKinney's new book on the Beatles called Magic Circles, and I stopped reading dead in mid-sentence, because what he said hit me with the force of an epiphany. I do look like a Beatle, at least my hair does, and so does the hair of a lot of other 40-something women. Bold on the top with bangs in the front, shaggy in the back. On good days, it looks like Paul's. On bad, flat like Ringo's. Decades ago, my generation of women sat transfixed before the family TV and watched the Beatles twist and shout on Ed Sullivan, and then played the Beatles the next day in living room concerts with our girlfriends. Critic Barbara Ehrenreich wrote about this phenomenon in her book, The Hearts of Men, and rightly said that we, then 7- and 8-year-old tweeny boppers, didn't so much want to date the Beatles as be them. Maybe subconsciously we still do. Our middle-aged mop tops are the giveaway. Devin McKinney wants to figure out Beatlemania and beyond in his book. He was born in 1966, as he points out, about a month after the Beatles gave their last live concert. But he's smart, and just as importantly, he's a fan, a Generation Xer who believes that rock and roll miracles can occur, even if he's never personally witnessed one on this scale. Magic Circles is the book to read, especially to gain a deeper understanding of the genesis of the Beatles and their early, joyous music. At his best, McKinney elucidates the central role the Beatles played in 1960s dream life. At his weakest, toward the end of his book, McKinney goes all mythic on us. But most of Magic Circles is so provocative and scrupulously researched, its faults are forgivable, just the way you forgive those instrumentals interlarded on the Help album, because a masterpiece like You've Gotta Hide Your Love Away is always just a groove or two ahead. In the beginning, McKinney tells us, the Beatles, previously named the Quarrymen, burrowed underground, playing basement holes like the Cavern Club, and also behaving like cultural parasites, piecing themselves together from skiffle music, Little Richard Roadhouse, and uptown girl group harmony. McKinney rightly analyzes every bootleg guitar twang from this subterranean period, looking for the moment. He finds it in 1960 at the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany. There, McKinney says, is the seed of all that came later, the mania, the Beatles pushing, their audience pushing back. McKinney talks brilliantly about the performances of this German chrysalis period, about how the Beatles take a song like Chuck Berry's Sweet Little 16 and beat it to within an inch of its life, precisely because they're not American. They had to work harder because the song's Americanisms don't mean anything to them or their German audience. Either it would rock or it would do nothing at all. And so out of this straining comes John Lennon's famous scream and the group's trademark breakouts and the Beatles' promise, musically and otherwise, that something will happen. McKinney goes on to do some terrific extended close readings of Beatles songs, especially controversial ones like Revolution, which was reviled by the New Left in 1968 for not being militant enough. Discussing their movies, he goes beyond the received wisdom of A Hard Day's Night, Great, versus Help, Sell Out, to look at the uncanny symbolic subtext of both films, in particular, Help's preoccupation with the Beatles' humiliation and sacrifice. In the year after Help, the Beatles would become a locus of hatred for anti-Western crowds in Japan and the Philippines, as well as conservative Christians in this country, thanks to Lennon's cheeky observation about the Beatles becoming more popular than God. McKinney stops at all the familiar shrines, holy and blasphemous, on the standard Beatles pilgrimage, but he offers lots of fresh, sometimes startling ideas as to why they're still worth revisiting. Of course, some of us, the aging Beatlemaniacs with the shaggy hair, won't need to be persuaded.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Magic Circles, The Beatles in Dream and History by Devin McKinney. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
We'll be right back.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Sundance Channel, presenting the TV premiere of Roger Dodger, starring Campbell Scott, on Saturday, November 15th at 9 p.m. Listings at sundancechannel.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Edward P. Jones. His debut book of stories, Lost in the City, won a Penn Hemingway Award. His new novel, The Known World, is about a black farmer and former slave who becomes a slave owner himself. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.